family member, we might direct them to resources to help make the peace or rearrange our plans to give them the time to do it. But we're not going to plan a vacation with the relative to force the issue. The same is true for getting in shape or work goals or making friends in a new neighborhood. We want to help them become the best version of the person they want to be. We support their dreams. We genuinely want to see them grow. But if we're trying to get them to do something we think would be best for them, they're not likely to trust our insights. When Sōkeian Shigetsu Sasaki, a Japanese monk who went on to found the Buddhist Society of America, had just started studying Zen Buddhism, he met legendary teacher Soyen Shaku, the first Zen Buddhist master to teach in the United States. Shaku had heard that Sōkeian was a woodcarver. "Carve me a Buddha," he said to the young monk. A few weeks later, Sōkeian presented Shaku with a wooden statue of the Buddha, which Shaku tossed out the window. As Sōkeian later said, it seemed an unkind action, but it wasn't. He'd meant for me to carve the Buddha in myself. Shaku didn't want a gift from Sōkeian. He wanted Sōkeian to do something for himself. The guru does not project their goals, ambitions, and timelines onto the student. The guru lets the student show them how to be supportive in the way that they need and want. But I also suggest you don't throw anything your partner gives you out the window. Try this. Help your partner know their goals. Instead of telling your partner what their goals should be and how to reach them, ask them three questions. 1. What's really important to you right now? 2. What do you need to get there? 3. Is there anything I can do to help you? In this way, you let your partner lead themselves to their answers. Understanding your partner's goals without editing them to suit yours is one of the greatest gifts you can give someone. When we hear other people's goals, we automatically put them through our filter and lens. That's too small or too big. Your perspective is important, but we don't want to project or predict. We don't want to share our own limitations or aspirations. Make sure to listen to their reasons, what motivates them, and why. You will learn from this too. Guide them to learn in their own way. In Kripa Moya Das's list, the guru is a friend and guide, always seeking their welfare as a well-wisher, Dirga Bandhum. To be a good guru, watch and access how your partner learns and determines the best way to present whatever it is you want them to learn. If they don't like reading, suggest podcasts. If that doesn't resonate with them, see if there's a course they'd like to take. I've had clients tell me, "My partner doesn't practice meditation or mindfulness enough. I am trying to make them read your book." My question would be, "What do they enjoy? Basketball? I have an amazing interview with Kobe Bryant. Music? Jennifer Lopez and Alicia Keys have both been on the podcast." Find a way to connect your partner to your interests through their interests. Try this. Identify your partner's learning style. Which learning style best describes your partner? Hearing. Your partner likes to take in new information through their ears. They like to listen to podcasts, audiobooks, or TED Talks. Vision. Your partner likes to watch someone demonstrate a skill or to follow a diagram. Your partner learns best from YouTube or masterclass. Thought. Your partner likes to absorb information in their head, so they might like to read a book on a topic of interest, taking notes to put it in their own words as they go. Motion. Your partner learns by doing. they'll want to take a workshop where they get to try out new skills as they acquire them. Match your partner to a learning style. To do this, first ask them if they know how they best learn. If they don't know, ask them when they last learned something new and what form it came in. If you're still drawing a blank, observe what they spend their spare time doing. Do they watch documentaries? Listen to audiobooks? You can even help them find a way to test all the approaches and see which one they prefer. Then give them guidance for how to learn using the formats I suggested for each style. You can give them a gift to inspire them, do some research for them, or experiment together. Gurus look for creative ways to share ideas for their partner rather than forcing them or pushing them. Wanting to help our partner should not be confused with wanting to control our partner. One of the most common ways we try to control our partner is to impose our timeline on them. You may do something in a day while your partner takes a week. Your timeline is not correct. A guru moves at the time and pace of the student without a deadline. If I said to Radhi, "Let's talk about your goals right now," she would shut down. But if I said to her, "On Sunday, let's go to a park and write in our journals about what we want from this year, then talk about it together," she would be delighted. I try to offer her suggestions that match her rhythm. Let your student set their own pace. And when they don't reach their goals and feel sad, don't say, "I told you to do it earlier." Be patient and thoughtful as they do the work, offering your time and resources and supporting them while giving them the confidence to do it on their own. Don't do it for them, but provide encouragement and guidance in a supportive way. Through this restraint, you're developing patience and compassion. This is how, as a guru, you yourself are growing as you help your partner grow. Don't criticize, judge, or abuse. Kripa Moya Das describes the guru as being free from deceitful speech, always telling the truth, satyavacham. I take this in a slightly different direction, where I ask you to be mindful of the way you speak to your partner so you don't mislead them or shut them down. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. Telling your partner they're sloppy won't change them. Stop playing PlayStation won't work. Think about the classroom where you would best learn. It is welcoming, accessible, and there is a natural flow of conversation and activity. Nobody wants a teacher who yells at the class or sends students to stand in the corner. We want students who respect teachers and teachers who respect students. A peaceful, sustainable exchange. Researchers have identified critical feedback as one of the most common triggers that send us into a fixed mindset, which Stanford professor Carol Dweck describes in her book Mindset as when we see our qualities as fixed traits that can't be changed. When we're in the fixed mindset, we focus on the perception that we've been judged to be somehow incompetent rather than seeing the growth opportunity that the criticism might provide. When our partner says, "When you do the laundry, all our clothes end up wrinkled," we hear something like, "You're inadequate and incapable." As a guru, we must pay attention to how we give feedback so it's more likely to be received in the spirit we intend. Something more like, "I really appreciate your help with the laundry. I realized that when I let the laundry sit in the dryer for a while before folding it, it ends up wrinkled. So now, if I have to run an errand or do something else, I don't start the dryer until I'm back." You might try another approach, but the main thing is, neither of us likes ironing. "You think we could try that? Or do you have a better idea?" Yes, communicating this way takes a lot more words. And yes, it requires more effort to frame your feedback this way. But it's worth it because it's more likely to keep the other person engaged and responsive to your criticism. Gurus don't use anger, harsh words, or fear to inspire their students. They realize that fear is a good motivator in the short term, but over the long term, it erodes trust. Criticism is lazy communication. It's not constructive, compassionate, or collaborative. Look for ways to communicate so that the person can consume, digest, and apply your input effectively. Offer them a love sandwich, where you deliver a piece of constructive criticism between two tasty slices of positive feedback. Give suggestions instead of criticism. For example, my client's husband was struggling with unreasonable demands from his boss. She wanted to say, "Well, you let them walk all over you," but that would injure his ego and hurt his feelings. Instead, she reminded him that he was very talented, but only human, and suggested that he talk to his boss not in terms of what he couldn't get done, but what he could get done in the allotted time. While his boss was unsympathetic and unyielding, my client's husband thanked her for supporting him, and on further discussion, they decided that after he finished his project, he would start looking for another job. Imagine you're taking a long-awaited vacation and your partner booked the Airbnb for the wrong date. Instead of berating them for their incompetence, remember all they did to plan this trip. Don't say, "You messed this up and you're going to figure it out." Instead, offer to book a hotel for the night while they sort out the Airbnb. Remember, you're trying to nourish your partner's joy. You highlight the good, you help create a path, you amplify their potential. Instead of criticizing in public, you compliment in public and in private. Instead of, "You never do X, you're so bad at Y," criticizing what they do wrong, say this: "I appreciate it when you do X," acknowledging what they do right. Instead of saying, "If you ever do that again, I'm leaving you," say, "This is how it makes me feel when you do that." Instead of saying, "Did you see what X's partner did for them?" say, "I really appreciate when you do X for me." Instead of saying, "This is your fault, so you fix it," say, "I know you're struggling with this. Can I help you?" Instead of saying, "You've changed, you were never like this before," say, "It's normal that we're changing and having to reset expectations." Become a better student. Some of us find it easier to lead than to be led, particularly when our partners aren't skilled and patient gurus. But even in those circumstances, we have the opportunity to learn from our partner. What if they just sit around all day? Well, maybe it irks you to see your partner relax because you don't allow yourself to take a break. Your partner is unconsciously teaching you that you need to give yourself downtime. And if our partner criticizes us or isn't inclined to help us grow, we must be the kind of student who by our behavior and qualities brings out the best in our guru. My guru at the ashram said that if a teacher was a 10 out of 10, then the student might only be a 1 out of 10 because the teacher would constantly uplift them. But if the teacher was a 1 out of 10, the student would have to rise to be a 10 out of 10 in order to learn from the teacher. In other words, if you approach your studies diligently enough, with an open mind and heart, you can learn even more from a mediocre teacher than you might from a great one. Be open-minded and curious. Kripa Moya Das also cites 15 qualities of the good disciple. One of them is Tattva Bodha Abhilasi, meaning has an eagerness to learn. The Buddhist term Shoshin means beginner's mind. We want to come to our relationship with the open willingness of a new student, no matter how long we've been together. Zen Master Shunryu Suzuki said, "In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few." As a student, being open to the new means that when your partner makes suggestions, inviting you to explore new ground, you're receptive. If your guru offers you bad advice or presents it harshly, avoid the understandable temptation to dismiss it or react with anger. Instead, explore the possibility that your partner might actually have some wisdom to share by asking them the right questions. Questions that aren't rhetorical or condescending, but rather are sincere efforts to understand the idea. You might ask, "Can you help me with specific ideas?" Or, "If I wanted to take your suggestion, where would I begin?" Or, "Could you explain that to me step by step?" Or, "I would love your advice. Can we discuss this when we're both in a better space?" There's an old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. It's a symbiotic relationship. Practice humility. To ask the right questions, one needs intelligence, but also humility. Humility doesn't mean to be meek and weak. It means being open to learning and honest with ourselves and others about our strengths and weaknesses. Kripamoya Das described the student as Tyaktamana, humble and prideless. Indeed, humility is essential for love in general because it keeps the ego, love's enemy, at bay. Ego and pride end more relationships than anything else because most misunderstandings are based on ego or pride. Ego mires us in the false belief that we're always right, that we know best, and the other person is wrong. This belief makes it impossible to learn from our partner. If you watch Nathan Chen skating in the Olympics, you don't think, "I'm such a bad skater, I'm small and worthless." You recognize and appreciate his grace and skill and the years of effort he put into his art. Humility is honoring other people's skills, abilities, and growth rather than dishonoring your own. Try this. Appreciate your partner's knowledge. Next time you're talking with your partner, notice an expertise they have that you usually take for granted. How can you find something extraordinary in what you already know about your partner? Maybe they think before they make a decision. Maybe they always write thoughtful thank you notes. Maybe they consistently offer you good advice when you don't know exactly how to ask for something at work. Look for skills your partner has that you've never acknowledged. When you notice one, share it with them. This appreciation is nourishment for your partner's strengths. Be a good translator. Kripamoya Das said that the student controls mind and speech, danta. Stephen Covey, author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, might agree with that guidance. He said, "Most people don't listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply." There are 3 steps to responding effectively when your partner shares an issue they have with you. First, echo what they said. Then say what you heard, explaining it back to them in your own words. Finally, when you're sure that you both understand the issue at hand, tell them how you feel. We tend to respond with what we feel first, using what they said to justify our feelings. Say your partner tells you, "I was embarrassed when you didn't introduce me to your friends." They're telling you how they feel. If you respond first with how you feel, you might say, "Well, you never include me in conversations with your friends." But if you tell them, "I'm hearing that you're upset with me. Why did it make you feel that way?" You give your partner an opportunity to make sure that they're explaining themselves effectively. You're showing them what they sound like and now they can be more focused on how they speak and share what they're saying. At the same time, you're clarifying what you're trying to do in the relationship, to connect and make the other person feel understood. Your guru can take a cue from the tone you set. Try this. Introduce a new idea. Practice your communication skills by bringing up a new topic and being attentive to what your partner says, listening to the points they make and helping them uncover and articulate the feelings, needs, and wants underneath their words. Pick an open-ended topic that you haven't discussed before, one that might inspire you both to imagine something new you might do together. Here are some suggested ideas. What if we both quit our jobs and moved? What if we traveled for a whole year? If we can retire one day, what would we do with our time? If we had $1 million to give away, who would we give it to and why? Here are some questions to explore. You can each answer these questions, but your focus should be on listening to your partner's responses. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when I ask this question? Why does what you said appeal to you? Then show your partner that you heard them. Explain to them what you heard them say their idea would be. Discuss what preferences and priorities you think might underlie that idea. Tell them what you learned about them in this conversation. Talk about whether there's a viable version of what they wanted that you could bring into your lives now. For example, if the question were, how would you spend a year of travel? Perhaps your inclination would be to move to the south of France to eat pain au chocolat for a year. But your partner wants to plan a bike trip across the US. You can recognize their longing for physical activity. Maybe they are also expressing a desire to experience travel at a slower pace, or to spend time camping along the way. Once you've understood more about their fantasy, you could consider getting them a bike for their birthday, or maybe you'll plan a weekend cycling trip together. This is practice for how you can listen to your partner instead of listening to reply when you encounter more challenging, emotionally loaded topics. Appreciate the guru. Kripa Moya Das said that the student is Krita Vid Shishya, grateful for knowledge. Notice and appreciate it when your partner is offering you help without reward or return. We don't often stop to thank them for their constant presence, their willingness to help, and the simple small things they do. Take time to thank them and notice what they get right and do well, even if it seems simple and easy. Showing gratitude like this creates a feedback loop where they feel grateful for your appreciation and are inspired to continue in their guru-like ways. Try this. Acknowledge the guru's skills. Think about your partner's skills as a guru. What are their strengths? Have you taken the time to acknowledge them? And if you perceive some of these areas as weaknesses, is there anything you can learn about yourself from your reaction? Find the areas where your partner is your guru and thank them. You can thank them out of the blue or the next time they show these qualities. 1. Leads through service. Your partner is willing to play any role in order to help you, even if it's not their field of expertise. Maybe they function as a manager, an accountant, an IT technician, a food delivery person. Do they help you out of compassion rather than telling you what to do? 2. Leads by example. What do they commit to and do without fail? If you can't find anything, you're probably not looking hard enough. 3. Helps you to your goals, not theirs. Your partner allows you to be yourself. They don't force or urge you to be different. They may not be serving or helping you, but when they don't force you to become someone you're not, That's a form of support. 4. Offers guidance without criticism, judgment, or abuse. When you've fallen short on your goals or made a mistake, your partner supports you and encourages you without pressuring you. Students need to be acknowledged as well. You can do the same exercise for the qualities of a student. Your guru is not your god. Alongside the openness of being a student comes perhaps the most important quality to your relationship with your guru, to maintain your sense of self. Just because you learn from them doesn't mean you shape yourself to their ideal and stop learning from anyone else. It doesn't mean you stop going to other people for different activities and insights. Your partner is your guru, not your god. They help you become better, but they aren't better than you. It's normal to take on some characteristics of our partners. Studies have found that couples start to adopt the same mannerisms, to sound alike, and even to eat the same quantity of food. Some merging of habits is inevitable, but we want to retain our individuality within the relationship. We want to take on positive qualities of our partner without becoming them or their assistant. You are always writing your story. When you meet someone, you start co-writing with them. The stories intertwine. In the Vedic scriptures, this is described as your karma being intertwined, but not your soul. I think of this as co-writing your karma together. Karma is the activity in your life, but your soul is your identity. You might change and grow together, mixing your karmas, mixing the energy of two families and two communities, but don't lose your identity. Remember your own personality, values, and goals. Don't lose the thread of your own story. Spend time in solitude. Don't cancel plans with friends and family. Pursue your own interests, not just your partner's. This is not slighting, ignoring, or betraying your partner. It's fueling your growth in ways that they can't, which means you'll have even more to offer them. And if you have no more growing left to do together, you can take time apart. That's okay. We must break up if our partner becomes abusive toward us. A guru would never teach through abuse. Abuse only teaches you to fear your partner, to suppress your instincts, to ignore your own pain, and to feed someone else's ego. Emotional, mental, and physical abuse should be deal breakers for everyone. And that's clear when you think about your partner as your guru. Why would your guru hurt you? How can you grow when you are hurt and scared? And if you're suffering in any of these ways but blame yourself, try asking yourself, am I learning from this person? Are they learning from me? Is this the way I want to learn? If the answers are no, then deciding to leave is the greatest gift you can give yourself. And there are many organizations that can help you do so safely. The Guru's Greatest Gift. We have heard people say of couples, they grew apart. But we never say, they grew together. Yet if you are not growing apart, that is most likely what you are doing. Quietly but surely helping each other observe, learn, and grow in all directions. The discomfort of change is offset by the delight of shared understanding. The growth that a guru and student cultivate keeps a relationship exciting and new even as it matures and you grow more familiar with each other. In the next chapter, we will talk about the most important way a guru can help a student grow in pursuing their purpose. Rule 5. Purpose comes first. The meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. David Viscott. Dharma, the compass. Many years ago, I asked a client and his partner to write down their priorities in order. His list said 1, kids, 2, you, meaning his wife, 3, work. Her list said 1, me, 2, kids, 3, you, meaning her husband. He was hurt and dismayed that she put herself above everything else. But then she explained, I put myself first because I want to give the best version of myself to you and our family. Putting oneself first sounds selfish, and it can be if you're eating all the cookies or grabbing the best seat at the table. But for any of us to bring the best version of ourselves to our relationships, we have to pursue our own purpose or spiritual calling. In Hinduism, it's called our dharma. Dharma is the intersection of passion, expertise, and service. Living in your dharma means that you've connected your natural talents and interests with a need that exists in the universe. Your dharma doesn't have to be your job. You're fortunate if you can earn a living following your calling, but that isn't always possible. Also, your purpose doesn't have to dominate your life. It might be a hobby, your involvement in church, being a parent, starting a company. It could be volunteering for a dog rescue in your spare time or organizing a local group to help people out of debt or blogging about budget travel. Dharma is not so much about any particular activity. It's more about why you do that activity, whether it's to create something, to connect people, to share what you've learned, to serve others or the world. Whatever it is, your dharma is not a casual interest. It's a passion. It defines you. When you practice it, you think, this is who I am. Your dharma is a journey, not a destination. It can take a long time to find the ways to best extract meaning, joy, and fulfillment from your pursuits. As long as a person is pursuing their purpose, they're already living it. The Vedas describe dharma as one of the 4 fundamental pursuits that drive us forward in life, shaping our choices and actions. The 4 pursuits are dharma, purpose; artha, work and finance; karma, pleasure and connection, your relationships with others; moksha, liberation from the material world when you connect with the spirit. Notice that dharma comes first in this list, which is no accident. The Vedas were intentional about the order, even though these pursuits overlap and intersect with one another throughout our lives. We may not think of purpose as a basic need like financial security and social connection, but it is actually even more essential. Dharma comes before artha because it guides how you spend your time, money, and energy. It gives meaning to the money. The same principle applies to relationships. If you have no sense of purpose, you don't bring thoughtfulness and compassion to your pursuit of pleasure. When you prioritize these 4 pursuits in the order the Vedas suggest, dharma clarifies your values and priorities to yourself and your partner. You pursue money with a clearer sense of how it should be spent, and you pursue love with a desire to create a meaningful life with your partner. Eventually, these 3 pursuits lead to moksha, where all we do is devoted to a spiritual journey. The Vedas aren't alone in prioritizing purpose. Researchers from the University of California, Los Angeles, and the University of North Carolina wanted to see whether hedonia, the kind of self-satisfaction that comes from opulences like fame or riches, along with personal gain and pleasure, looks different in our bodies from eudaimonia, the satisfaction that comes from having a deep sense of purpose and meaning in life. They gave participants a survey asking questions such as how often they feel happy, hedonia, and how often they feel that their life has a sense of direction and meaning, eudaimonia. The researchers found that while those with higher levels of hedonia generally experienced more positive feelings, they had weaker immune profiles, including higher inflammation and other markers that made them more prone to illness. Anthony Burrow, a professor of human development at Cornell University, led another study that showed a strong sense of purpose can even make us immune to the likes or lack of likes we garner on social media. First, he and his research partner had participants fill out a series of questionnaires measuring the degree to which they felt connected to a sense of purpose in life. Then, the participants were told they would be helping to test a new social networking site. First, they had to start building their profiles by posting a selfie. The researchers gave them a camera, then pretended to upload the image to the fictional website. Then, after 5 minutes, they told the participants how many likes their selfie had gotten compared with other people's photos: above average, about the same, or below average. Finally, the participants filled out another questionnaire that measured self-esteem. It turned out that those with less of a sense of purpose in life experienced spikes or drops in their self-esteem based on how many likes their selfie got or didn't get, while those with a stronger sense of purpose were relatively unaffected. Their self-esteem held steady. Purpose insulates and protects our self-esteem, and researchers connected high self-esteem to more satisfying relationships. As Burrow says, we are confronted with the ups and downs of life, but purpose is an active ingredient that helps us stay stable. We bring that stability to one another. It's a foundation on which we can build our life with our partner. There's a story attributed to the Buddha about two acrobats, a master and his assistant. The master climbed to the top of a bamboo pole and told his assistant to follow and stand on his shoulders. We will demonstrate our skill for the crowd, and they will give us some money. You will look out for me, and I will look out for you, and that way we will be safe. The assistant assessed the situation, then shook her head. No, master, she said. You will look after yourself, and I will look after myself, and then we will show our skill. And in that way, we will make some money and be safe. This is why my client's wife was onto something when she put her purpose first in her list of priorities. A couple's approach to their dharmas should be like that of the assistant acrobat. You go do what you need to do, while I go do what I need to do. People think that putting the other person first is a sign of love. We romanticize the idea of making sacrifices and devoting ourselves to another person, and there are beautiful ways to do so. But I've seen people who put their own purpose aside and years down the line feel lost or misled. They regret their choices and resent their partners for not helping them prioritize their purpose, and with reason. I don't condone resentment, but if your partner can bear to watch you give up your purpose, that's not love. Your purpose has to come first for you, and your partner's purpose has to come first for them. Then you come together with the positive energy and stability that come from pursuing your purposes. You may wonder why I'm talking about finding your own purpose in a book about relationships. It's something you do in solitude, even within a relationship. But just as solitude helps us enter a relationship with self-knowledge, so knowing our purpose helps us sustain and grow a relationship, holding on to our sense of purpose and supporting our partner's efforts to do so too. In every relationship, there are actually three relationships: your relationship with each other, your relationship with your purpose and your partner's relationship with their purpose. We need to pay attention to all three. This seems hard, but it actually makes life easier. If you want to truly love someone and give them your best self, then you have to be your best self. Much as a depleted parent has a harder time caring for their children, a person who doesn't take care of their own purpose has a hard time supporting their partner in theirs. By looking after ourselves, we prepare to look after others. As marriage and family therapist Kathleen Darlin DeVos told HuffPost, the happiest couples are those who can move past their initial obsession with each other to prioritize their own pursuits and goals. When couples rely solely on each other to meet all of their emotional intimacy and social needs, this merging can stifle healthy personal growth or threaten to slip into codependency. DeVos adds that couples need to maintain their individual identity within the relationship rather than let the relationship define them. When you are both actively pursuing your purpose, your relationship benefits in several ways. Dharma helps you live a passionate, inspired, motivated life, a life you want to share with someone. You also have the pleasure of living alongside someone who is fulfilled. There is great joy in seeing the person you love doing what they love. Furthermore, you're more aware of and sympathetic to the struggles they might have along the way. When we aren't pursuing our purposes, troubles arise. Sometimes when you think there's a problem between you and your partner, the root of the dissatisfaction is that one or both partners aren't following their purpose. My client Amy was upset that her partner Marco, a guitarist in an up-and-coming band, was always touring. But when he cut a tour short to spend more time with her, she felt too guilty to enjoy it. She realized that if she herself had a goal to work toward, that would better solve the issue between them. When Amy, who is a painter, started teaching lessons out of a friend's garage, she got excited to put on a group show with their best work. Marco made sure he could leave the tour to attend the opening of the show. And though she was busy during his visit, she felt proud of what she had accomplished and happy to share it with him. Even in a household that looks ideal, where your work lives and home life check all the boxes, if either partner doesn't know their purpose or isn't actively engaged in it, that individual emptiness impacts the relationship. The partner without a purpose might become envious of the other's progress, in which case both partners miss out on the joy, energy, and contentment that two people who are fueled by their purpose bring to each other. If one person in a couple feels lost, they might start to feel like their partner, who's comparatively busy and fulfilled, doesn't care about them. The busy partner might worry about their partner not having a life beyond the relationship. They might feel responsible for entertaining their partner and keep them busy. Ultimately, each might resent the other for how they spend their time. In a relationship, we must be careful that neither partner loses track of what they care about, what they value, and what makes them feel true to themselves. Now we'll look first at how you can prioritize your dharma within a relationship, and then at how to help your partner prioritize their dharma. How to prioritize your dharma. Sal Khan went to business school, but he didn't think he had the fortitude to be an entrepreneur. Instead, he began a lucrative career at a startup hedge fund. Then, during a visit from family, he discovered that his 12-year-old cousin was struggling with math. Sal offered to tutor her remotely. It was 2004, so the pair used a combination of phone calls and early messenger technology. Within a few months, under his tutelage, Sal's cousin retook her math placement test and went from a remedial class to an advanced class. Soon, other family members, then friends, all over the country began reaching out to Sal for tutoring. Sal started recording his lessons and uploading them to YouTube. Plus, he created custom software for people to practice the lessons. Khan Academy was born. Sal still enjoyed his hedge fund job, but he felt most engaged and excited by the opportunity to share his lessons in the hopes they'd help others. He had found his purpose. If you don't know where to start, I recommend following this progression. The Pyramid of Purpose. Learn. Devote time to learning in the area of your purpose. Experiment. Take what you learned and try it out for yourself in order to discover what works for you and what doesn't. Thrive. Perform your purpose, building consistency and steadiness in what you're doing. Struggle. Face the challenges that inevitably come and use them for growth. Win. Celebrate successes, big and small. Learn. Purpose begins with curiosity. We think starting means doing, but it actually begins with learning. Don't skip or avoid the learning phase. The reason we say knowledge is power is that it can help you overcome any fear of the unexpected. Try this. Learn about your purpose. We learn about our purpose by considering and exploring our interests and skills. Passions. Ask yourself questions to identify your passions. If you could be paid to do anything, what would it be? Are there hobbies you loved as a kid, but don't do anymore? Do you have a hidden talent? Have you seen someone else that you consider to have your dream job? Is there something you'd be doing if you weren't limited by where or how you live? Is there something you used to be good at that you miss? Is there a talent you haven't been able to pursue lately? Strengths. Identify what roles you play at home or at work to identify your strengths. The organizer. Plans birthdays and trips and keeps life on schedule. The organizer is focused on deadlines, results, and the big picture. You're good at directing people. The energizer. Outgoing, enthusiastic, and optimistic. The energizer gets people excited to go do what the organizer planned. The empathizer. Emotionally intelligent, patient, a good listener, and supportive. The empathizer is intuitive about how people are feeling. The analyzer. Detail-oriented, systematic, careful, and cautious. The analyzer spots issues that could become problematic. Your purpose is where your passions intersect with your skills. Once you've identified passions and skills, find ways to learn about them. 1. Take a class, read a book, or listen to a podcast in your area of interest. Can you get a certification that will help you develop your talent? 2. Look for groups of people who can inspire you by what they're doing or how they do it. 3. Try out something in the area of your purpose over the weekend. Observe what excites you and deepens your interests. My favorite way to learn is to speak to people who are already doing what I want to do. When a doctor goes to a conference on a specific disease, they connect with other doctors studying that disease. They learn about advances in science. They hear about new treatments or research. The same is true in any area of passion. A mentor will help you form a vision of how you can start to pursue your purpose and what your life might look like as you continue to live in your purpose. The mentor can also give you concrete advice as first steps you can take, how you can network, and where else you can turn to learn more. Even if you can't find people in your field, just being around others who are actively pursuing their purpose can be extremely inspiring. Ask questions. Be curious. Find people who enjoy talking about how they found their way. If they're not in your community, look to the greats who tell their stories in books, on YouTube, in TED Talks, and on podcasts. Try this. Meet with a mentor. 1. Find potential mentors. Use your existing contacts to connect with people who are experts in your field. Reach out to them on social media. Examine the resources you used to learn, books, TED Talks, podcasts, and follow up to see if those who might have guidance to offer are willing to give you even 10 minutes to ask them questions. 2. Ask questions, take notes on their responses. Start with logistical, tactical, and practical questions. How did you get started? What did you do to improve? What techniques do you use? Do you have partners? And any other questions about how the process works? Don't be afraid to be specific with your questions. When you don't ask specific questions, you don't get specific answers. You can also ask emotional and mental questions that can help give you an idea what you might love about the process and what you may struggle with. What part of the process do you enjoy most? What do you hate about the process? What do you wish you'd known when you started? 3. Process. After talking to a mentor, look at your notes. Are there people you should call? Skills you should develop? Opportunities you should pursue? Translate the information you were given into action items and put them into your calendar where relevant. In order to learn, you have to commit time. And in order to commit time, your partner has to be on board. They have to understand the values that make you want to spend your time this way, and you want to make sure that they don't feel like you're stealing the time from them or your family, if you have one. You do this by working together to decide where the time will come from. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Bridget Schulte was struggling with the conflicting demands of work and parenting. She had no time for herself, including any passion projects she hoped to take on. At one point, desperate to squeeze extra time from her schedule, she took a time use survey where she recorded what she did all day. The results shocked her, showing that she had an extra 27 hours in her week. The time was largely invisible to Schulte because it was in scraps of 10 minutes here and 20 minutes there, or time confetti, as she dubbed it. By jumping around from task to task throughout her days, switching focus among her to-do list and her phone and other distractions, Schulte was shredding her schedule. Once she started batching her tasks and eliminating unnecessary distractions, she found longer blocks of time, which she says are essential to learning, coming up with new ideas, and seeing things we might not see otherwise. Ultimately, she found enough time to research and write a book, Overwhelmed, which became a New York Times bestseller. Try this, spare time worksheet. You can recover lost time by documenting every minute of your day and batching tasks as Schulte did. But this exercise is a simpler approach, where we look at whether the time we're spending is in alignment with our values. Show yourself what you truly value by devoting a consistent proportion of your free time to learning in the area of your purpose. With your partner's help, look at how you currently spend your spare time, both together and apart. This is also a great way for the two of you to get a snapshot of your values and to see if you want to make any other changes to how you spend your free time. First, calculate the total hours you spend every week on the activities I'm about to share with you and any others you'd like to include. Then, calculate how much time you're willing to take away from those activities and reallocate to learning about your purpose. Let's take refueling and pure leisure. The time you currently spend might be 4 hours a week. Moving forward, you'll spend 3 hours a week for this activity. Exercise. Let's say you currently spend 4 hours a week. This you're going to keep the same. Socializing. Currently, it's at 8 hours a week, and from now, it will be 7 hours a week. Entertainment. Currently, it's at 15 hours a week. From now, it will be 10 hours a week. In this example, the total time spent on activities that are not your purpose is 31 hours. Moving forward, you're going to commit 24 total hours to those activities, leaving you with 7 hours reallocated towards your purpose. Engage your partner in this process. If you don't communicate with your partner about what you're excited to pursue, they may wonder why you don't want to spend time with them. If they sign on to this plan, they'll understand and respect why you're spending your time as you do. Experiment. Experimenting is putting your learning into practice to find out what works for you and what doesn't. You conduct mini tests of what you've been pursuing. If you took a communication class that told you to look people in the eye when you talk, now you make a concerted effort to follow that advice. If you want to teach, you could try offering a seminar, helping out another teacher, or starting a blog. If you want to sell a craft, you could start posting on Etsy. If you want to offer a service, you could test it out by doing it for free for your friends. Apprenticing, shadowing, interning, and volunteering are all ways of dipping your toe in the waters of something you think might be your purpose. This period of experimentation is meant to take the pressure off. No judgment, no criticism, and no guilt from yourself or your partner. You don't have to be perfect. Mistakes can give you valuable information about both your skill level and your field of interest. In this phase, you can invite your partner to come with you as you experiment. A lot of couples may try to take a class together, read the same book, or watch a documentary at the same time. This is great if you share interests, but if they can't come or aren't interested, don't be disheartened. This is your purpose, not theirs. We often pressure our partners to be as enthusiastic as we are about our passion. Or we wonder if they're right for us, because when we talk about our passion, they don't have much to add to the conversation. Our partner doesn't have to share our passions. Even if they do, that doesn't guarantee success in a relationship. Remind yourself why you are with them and remember that being alike isn't necessary for a happy relationship. Besides, it's often better for each of you to do your own learning. Then you can move at your own pace and bring what you've found to your partner. This way, your partner is still part of the process and they don't feel mystified or alienated as you proceed. You want your partner to feel loved and connected as you find ways to learn and develop your purpose. Just be sure to let them know when you'll be experimenting so that they can decide how they want to schedule the time. Perhaps they'll be experimenting too. Learning and experimenting could be a 5-month journey or a 5-year journey. Remember, no matter where you are on the pyramid of purpose, you are already in pursuit of purpose. There is no finish line to cross before you're living your purpose. Thrive. Learn and experiment until you hit a level of expertise where you know what you love and what you don't love about your purpose, what works and what doesn't. Then you go for it. Learning doesn't yield results, and the results from experimenting are random. Now you're making those efforts serve you. You take steps to perform your purpose, building consistency and steadiness. This might mean accepting a new job. It might mean launching a small business. It might mean rescuing a dog or volunteering as a teaching assistant. This new effort takes time, but you establish a routine and set measurable goals. You wanted to jump into doing at the start, but your performance will only be as strong as the learning and experimenting you did beforehand. If the results aren't satisfactory, then you go back to learning and experimenting. If nobody is visiting your Etsy shop, you make efforts to learn how to market it. If you feel like you could be a better teaching assistant, ask the lead teacher to mentor you. When you can produce measurable, replicable results and you start to get noticed, it builds confidence and motivates you to keep pushing forward. In order to thrive, you have to ramp up your efforts, and pursuing your purpose may start to consume more of your time and energy. It's vital that you